Welcome to Wednesday's Main Street here on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Coming up in just a bit, Prairie Plates, fresh from the heart. It's Maria's homestyle Mexican that's now come to Fargo. Plus on Prairie Beat, a compelling conversation with a North Dakotan living in the Twin Cities. Today on Main Street, we're looking at how a university plans for the future, not just academically, but physically. Classrooms, housing, walkways, green space, traffic flow, and the kinds of places that shape student life and research. The University of North Dakota has now kicked off a new 10-year campus master plan, building on work that UND says has already reshaped campus through the 2016 and 2022 master plans, including major facility replacements, preservation of historic assets, and a big emphasis on using space more efficiently. UND is also inviting the public to participate right now, and we'll get to how that can be done through surveys and upcoming forums. Joining us is Eric Link. He's UND's Vice President for Academic Affairs and Provost, and Les Biore. He's UND's Director of Planning and Design. Provost Link and Les, welcome to Main Street.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Glad to be here.
Glad that you are both with us today. This is such an interesting topic to me. Of course, I think, and Provost Link, let me begin with you. When people hear master plan, I think they just might picture blueprints or construction fences. So in plain language, what is a campus master plan and what problems is it meant to solve?
That's a great question, Craig. And thank you so much for giving us a chance to visit with you about this exciting initiative that we are embarking on here at the University of North Dakota. A campus master plan gives us an opportunity to really look at the macro level, at the whole of campus, all of the structures, the landscaping, the facilities, the parking, the athletic facilities, all of the things that make up this enterprise called the University of North Dakota, and make sure that we have a plan for the next 5 to 10 years to develop it in a way that will help us meet our mission and our vision to provide excellent education for our students, great research opportunities for faculty, opportunities for community engagement and beyond. It really is a chance for us to look at the whole of campus in light of our campus strategic plan, which has, you know, set forth a mission and a vision for the future of the university.
In the UND press release, you said, I believe that, and I quote, "It's not just buildings and beautification." What do you want listeners to understand, Provost, about why this matters to education and discovery and research?
Yeah, you know, it's, again, to go back to what you just said, it's the physical structures are important, but it's the function that they serve in helping us deliver quality academic experiences for the students that is really of most importance. So when you think about just the changes that have happened in U.S. education in the past 10 or 20 years, we could talk most recently about the impacts of artificial intelligence and virtual learning environments, but the introduction 20 years or so ago of online education for distance students. Meanwhile, we have new pedagogies being developed in terms of classroom interaction and new directions with experiential learning and how we get our students to give them opportunities to have hands-on learning experiences and to do research projects. We need to make sure that the campus is able to accommodate those kinds of changes in the way we deliver academic programmings to our students. So it's not about buildings, it's about what happens inside those buildings.
Provost, it's been said that UND in the 2016-2022 master plans focused less on expansion and more on consolidation, using space more effectively. What did that look like in practice?
So one of the things that I think UND has benefited from over the past decade is that that 2016 master plan was a very good plan and has been followed. It's been really effective as a guiding instrument for campus. At that time, we had a lot of buildings that were in disrepair, a lot of deferred maintenance on campus. We needed to be very intentional in thinking about what the future of this campus should look like And a lot of the early work for that 2016 master plan did involve taking down a number of buildings and rethinking how we can use space on this campus. That was very effective on campus, and campus really has been transformed over the past 10 years. In 2022 or so, less, as you will recall, we revisited that 2016 master plan and largely affirmed that we were on the right track and we were doing good work on behalf of the campus. Now we're in kind of a different space because we have kind of, you think of, reconceptualized the physical layout of the campus. We've had a lot of construction. We have some great projects that have just wrapped up and are about to commence in terms of physical buildings on campus. But we're able to do so from a much stronger place because of all the work that was done in the past decade.
I want to bring the numbers to the table because I think they're striking. UND reports that it removed 1.6 million gross square feet of building and built 826,000 gross square feet for a net reduction of 932,000 gross square feet of building. And then interestingly, a cost savings of $334 million in deferred maintenance savings. What should we take away from those numbers? Because that sure seems like a lot of less footprint.
Yeah, that was all part of right-sizing, you know, the campus, I guess, is the term that we were using. What we found in the 2016 master plan is that the university really had more than enough square footage to perform its mission, but the quality of that space was poor and inadequate. And so it took a decade to make our way through to where we are now. And it has been a bit of a transformation to the university, but not what I think is going to happen in the future. You're going to see a significant transformation now, as Provost Link indicated. You know, it made us stronger for what is coming ahead.
How do you balance the historic with the need for the present? And I look back at my time at the University of Wyoming. I spent many hours in what was Wyoming Hall. My department, my computer science department, was there. Well, it's no longer there. It's a brand new dorm. It's something different. And part of me says, that's too bad, but boy, is the new dorm beautiful. So how do you balance the need to hold on to historic beauty, historic memories, with what's new and what's changed and what's coming?
Yeah, I think the best approach that we did was Merrifield. If you look at that, that's an iconic historic building on campus, and we kept all of those historic fabric inside that building, but yet modernized it. And so if you look at that kind of micro approach and then, you know, translate that to a campus-wide approach, I think you start to understand, you know, the complexity that it is. We've had some significant historical renovations in Carnegie, you know, that saved that particular building. But there have been others, unfortunately, that were past that point and you know, they had to be demolished. So that's just how it goes, I guess. You probably want to cut some of that out.
I don't know. I mean, it's all important because it's the natural, I guess, matriculation of what a campus becomes, right? I mean, we've all seen it everywhere. What cities become, what communities become, things change. But from the academic side, Provost Link, how do these physical changes really help you, I guess, with your mission? Take us a little deeper into that. Student success, recruitment and retention for your staff and employees, research growth, and also talk about partnerships, because it's striking to me the amount of private investment that the University of North Dakota has, when primarily in my alma mater, the University of Wyoming, pretty much the legislature has built everything.
All of those things you mentioned, Craig, have been important factors in the work that we've done over the past decade or so. Indeed, the entire eastern side of campus, for the most part, has really been completely, that's where a lot of our athletic facilities are. As you're coming up, if you know the area, Columbia, and you hit University, what the projects we call the Hislop at Memorial Village and the Fieldhouse at Memorial Village, those spaces were created through public-private partnerships. a way to engage with the community, with community partners, to do great work, not only for the university, but that serves the city of Grand Forks and the region as well. That has allowed, those kinds of partnerships have allowed this university to really accelerate the work that it has done to modernize and revitalize its campus. And I fully expect that that kind of work will continue under the next master plan as well. When you think about some of the, like getting the physical spaces of campus ready to meet the needs of the modern student, there's so many factors that go into that, not only from making sure we have health and wellness spaces, recreational spaces, good campus services for student health and so forth. We have to build that into the campus master plan. We have to be intentional about that work to make sure that the students who come here have the support services that they need to be successful here on campus. So that's an important part of what it means to build an effective master plan as well.
Enjoying my conversation with Provost Eric Link. He's UND's Vice President for Academic Affairs and Provost, and also Les Biore. He's UND's Director of Planning and Design. What's driving the timing for a new master plan now, Provost Link? What decisions does UND need to be ready to make for the next decade?
Those are two good and related questions. As Les can also attest to, we are required periodically to engage in a campus master planning process. And it is time to do that. The previous master plan, really referring to the one developed in 2016, as I mentioned, has been very effective in guiding work on campus for a decade. We've checked a lot of boxes that we set for ourselves on that campus master plan. So the timing is ideal for engaging in this exercise now. But even setting aside the requirements to do this kind of work periodically, we really need to be intentional as a campus. All institutions have to be intentional about making sure that the what goes on inside our buildings, what goes on across our campus, is designed to help us meet our mission and our vision, the needs of our community, the needs of our students, to help promote research on campus. Our research enterprise has been growing substantially in recent years here on campus. And so we have to have really intentional conversations about research spaces and laboratory spaces and how to create those opportunities, not just for our faculty, but for our students, both undergraduate and graduate, to be involved in those research activities as well. So there's so much that goes into an effective campus master planning process.
I'm curious with one more question for you, Provost Link, and then I have some more for Les. It seems to me today across the country, enrollment has declined in U.S. universities. It's not the case at the University of North Dakota, at least right now. So with the pressures on what it means to be a college student these days, and maybe in the future, we all hear the stories about student debt and other things, and there is pressure for college students, yet UND has flourished for sure by all accounts. How does that all enter in to what you're thinking about UND's future is all about?
Boy, it's a really important question, and it's one we wrestle with on a weekly basis here on campus. We're very, of course, pleased by the success of the university. We are at a record all-time high enrollment in the institution's history. We've been growing for 5 years consecutively, and we don't anticipate, we think that trend's going to continue at least for a little while longer. But you're absolutely right. There's a lot of talk at the national level about demographic shifts and enrollment cliffs and all the things you hear about in terms of the number of students going into higher education. University of North Dakota has been very intentional in trying to make sure that we stick to our fundamentals, that we provide great learning experiences, that we provide great support services for our students, great research opportunities for faculty, and we want that work to continue with this next campus master plan.
Less student life is certainly shaped, was for me, by in-between spaces where students gather, they study, they decompress, they recreate. But maybe those needs are different today than they were from when I went to school. What are you listening for today when students talk about what works and what doesn't?
Well, a lot of that really centers itself on collaboration. You know, in the old days, you used to walk into a collegiate building, and it was a straight hallway with classrooms on each side, and nobody had the opportunity to interact with one another. And that just isn't the thing nowadays. When you design a building, you purposely put in, you know, study spaces and collaboration type spaces, and it's more of an interdisciplinary reaction, you know, to the environment of the student nowadays.
Provost Link, what do you feel today when you think about the need for campus safety for your students, for your faculty, for your staff, and I guess for visitors who come to campus?
Really important. We, again, place a premium on safety on this campus. We're very proud of our record of safety at UND, and we're never less resting on those laurels. We want to make sure that everyone who walks onto campus has a great experience, is safe, whether they are students in the residence halls or faculty in their laboratories, or visitors attending an athletic event or going, you know, to see a performance in the Chester Frith Performing Arts Center. We want everyone to know that they're going to have a great and safe experience on campus. That's complicated. There's so much that goes into creating a safe campus for the entire community. It extends not just from, of course, our safety officers on campus, but also our labs, our laboratory safety specialists, and others who are constantly focused on making sure we improve and maintain a safe campus.
This question will be for you both. Les, I'll give it to you first. In the press release about this effort, you've talked about sustainability. I feel that maybe in the last year, sustainability has become less important in a lot of things in society than it was maybe 2, 5, 6 years ago. But it can mean a lot of different things. It can mean energy use. It can mean materials, it can mean transportation, and certainly long-term operating costs, which you want to minimize, I'm sure. So given UND's earlier consolidation work, what does sustainability mean to you, Les, and then to you, Provost Link, in this upcoming master plan? What strategies do you feel are on the table?
Yeah, we have, of course, we have to meet, all of our buildings have to meet the energy code that is now prevalent in the state of North Dakota, and they just recently updated that. And so, you know, some of the things that we have done on campus is all of our buildings are designed to a minimum LEED silver rating. And one of the other things that we are looking at is, you know, the recycling of material. We have done a lot of demolition on campus over the years, and we've always made sure that, you know, a large portion of that is recycled, you know, the debris is recycled. So those are a couple of things I think that just come to mind.
Provost Link, do you have any ideas about sustainability?
Yeah, you know, I would go back to something you cited a few minutes ago, Craig, the overall net reduction under the last master plan of almost 1 million square feet of usable space on this campus actually speaks to the concept of sustainability itself, right? Not just in terms of, as Les was talking about, energy usage and efficiency, but also in terms of how we are able to make sure we build a campus that we can do the deferred maintenance on, that we can keep in good repair, that will continue to meet the needs of our students of the next generation.
For both of you, when you get feedback that conflicts, students want more gathering space, departments want more research space, neighbors don't want anybody driving by their house to get to the university, how do you adjudicate competing priorities?
I mean, It's a great question, a tough one to answer in a sense. I'll say this, one of the things that we take some pride in and have been very conscientious about at UND is making sure that anytime we engage in a kind of campus-wide planning exercise like this campus master planning, that we get as much feedback as we can from all interested parties. Every voice is important to us. We want every idea, big and small, to be on the table so that we can have the greatest range of perspectives on what the future of this campus should look like. Everyone's got their own ideas. We can't build them all into a master plan, but we want all those ideas on the table so we can at least talk about them and try and put the jigsaw pieces together in a way that is conscientious about sustainability, about affordability, about sustainability and the future of educational experiences, athletic experiences, and so forth.
Les, when you hear it all from every side, from the top, from the bottom, from the left and the right, man, how do you deal with it?
I bring all those options to leadership and wait for their answer.
There is an opportunity coming on February 5th from 1 to 2 p.m. at Memorial Union for people to contribute here. There is also an online survey that's open until February 11th. Provost Link, how can people participate?
Yeah, these are some great opportunities for folks who might want to listen in, maybe provide some ideas, some feedback on what they think of campus and what they think the future of the UND campus should be. If they click on the survey, if they get that survey link, it will only take them 15, 20 minutes to go through the survey, but all that feedback is being gathered and analyzed. It's really important to our process. The forum on the 5th will be a great way to kind of introduce this year-long exercise that we're undergoing, and I would encourage anyone who is interested to tune into that as well.
And that will be live streamed too, right?
I believe that's true. Les, can you verify that?
Yes, that is true.
10 years from now, there's going to be a headline written somewhere about the University of North Dakota's campus. What do you hope it says?
I'm going to pass this on to Provost Link.
All right, Provost, what do you hope it says?
I hope 10 years from now, the headline says that UND is a campus that is beautiful, welcoming, and it serves the needs of its student and its community to the highest ability. We really want this campus to be something that we're all proud of, but even more so, that serves the needs of students, faculty, staff, community members, the region, and the state. The role we play within the state of North Dakota is extraordinarily important, and we want to make sure that the University of North Dakota continues to be kind of a great beacon of education across the state.
That's Eric Link. He's UND's Vice President for Academic Affairs and Provost, and also Les Biore. He's the UND Director of Planning and Design. Both have been talking about UND's new 10-year campus master plan and how the public can participate through surveys, upcoming forums. You can find the participation links and details through the University of North Dakota website. Look for UND Today and UND's events calendar. To both of you, best wishes, and thank you for joining us on Main Street.
All right.
Thank you so much, Craig. Appreciate the conversation.
Still to come on Main Street, fresh from the heart, Prairie Plates visits Maria's Homestyle Mexican in Fargo, plus a North Dakotan at the epicenter of the immigration crisis in the Twin Cities. That's ahead. Stay with us.
Welcome to another edition of Prairie Plates here on Main Street, here on Prairie Public, served up weekly. We have a guest this week to talk about some warm flavors during this cold week, Maria Ostos with Maria's Homestyle Mexican Restaurant, which is a new Mexican restaurant in downtown Fargo. I've been there a few times. I had a breakfast burrito called the Macho Man, which I really enjoyed. Oh, yeah. Some street tacos. And I really like pozole. I like pork and chicken. The chicken variety that you had was really, really good. I really enjoy the fresh onions, radishes, cilantro, that sort of thing. The fresh flavors at Maria's is what really attracts me there. But Maria Ostos, welcome to Prairie Plates.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
Well, thanks for being here. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
I'm a mother of six, grandmother of seven, and happily married to Frank Ostos. And we've been now living here in Fargo, North Dakota for 18 years.
Your husband's a very nice guy, by the way.
Yes, he is.
Next time, bring him too.
I should have.
Well, what's your background in food service? You have a long history.
So growing up, my mom and my grandmother worked in restaurants. When I was really young, my grandmother's family had owned a restaurant. And so I remember being in there rolling the forks into the napkins and just watching them, being a part of that. And then that probably around eight or so, that kind of went away. And I don't know the details behind that, but just they stayed in the restaurant business, being waitresses and whatnot. And then grandma's cooking at home, and that's kind of it. I kind of fell into waitressing for a little while and working fast foods. And that was all the experience I had at first.
I think everyone should serve in a restaurant as a job at some point.
Yes.
You really learn how to connect with people and, mm-hmm. and deal with all of the challenges that come
yep.
with working in a restaurant.
Right. Because then you learn a new appreciation also for the people that are doing the work and what they have to go through. And
you learn how grumpy the cooks can be.
There you go. You said it.
Well, tell us a little bit about your style of food at Maria's. A lot of people, you know, talk about California style, Tex-Mex, that sort of thing. Where are you at with that, those flavors?
I'm more Californian style because that's where I grew up. That's where I was born and raised. And with the touch of a little bit of Mexico, my grandmother comes from Guadalajara, Jalisco. And so that's where all of our roots come from. And her style of cooking comes from, and the recipes that were passed down from her is that style. And then just growing up in our neighborhood, you know, so there's a different style. You can go to even Southern California to Northern California, and you're going to find same foods, but differences within those foods. You know, the recipes are going to vary from the toppings. And it's the same as if you went traveling to Mexico. You got different regions, so you got different styles of the same food, but, you know, it comes out just slightly different.
And describe the flavors or the ingredients a little bit more in California style.
Well, for me, in my opinion, it's just the freshness, you know. It's we have so much natural items growing there for us, you know. So everything's about freshness, from the seafood, from the vegetables, you know, to everything you can think of. And so it's just that style of freshness. You're not buying the canned goods, and you're not mixing certain pre-made stuff into it. It's all made from scratch and from the heart.
And that's why what I enjoy about your restaurant is the fresh ingredients and the healthy mm-hmm. aspect of it. Well, you went from a food trailer that I see at the Red River Market a lot and around the area to a brick and mortar. But how did you end up first starting the food trailer?
Well, actually, if I can talk about it, I go further back. First, I started with just catering, small amounts of catering jobs, and that kind of just started to grow. Word of mouth about me started to spread. And then that went into me leaving retail and fully going into this business. And so as the catering jobs picked up, I learned about the Red River Market. So then we started doing pop-ups there under a tent. And then that we did for a good 5 years, which then that allowed us to grow. And like I'm talking from a one table, one tent, very little equipment, to two tents, full equipment, to then the food trailer. So each new year bought us something new to keep growing the business.
And I may have been following you through this progression because the food is really good.
Thank you.
Well, tell us about your new restaurant.
So the idea and the dream and the goal has always been to be small, to be intimate. It allows me to stay connected to my community on a more one-on-one basis. And I'm also inspired by a small taqueria back home called El Charito's. And I grew up eating them. Her story is so similar. She was a mother, a grandmother. She did this all on her own. She kept it within the family. And I don't know, I've always just enjoyed that. And then the food was always delicious. So I've aspired to bring that here. Here where we don't always have that kind of style of food and, I don't know, warmth.
And I think one of the things that makes your restaurant unique is it's a family affair as well.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. I got currently in the restaurant. My son is managing it. My mother helps in all various ways in the background. I got my nephew, my daughters, like everybody's just in there, you know, one way or another, they got hands on this.
And your husband's being a good man hanging out in there too.
Yes, he is. He's actually the more of the technical and the, you know, computer aspect of the world, our advertising. And he does help crunch the numbers, you know. So he runs the other side behind the scenes.
Well, let's get to the food. Tell us about your menu.
Okay, so our menu concept is to serve breakfast and lunch. We do breakfast from 8 a.m. to 11 a.m. And I've always wanted to showcase breakfast burritos. And we've ran them from time to time on the trailer as specials, and they were always a big hit. So that was a part of the idea, was to build this menu based on our community's favorites throughout all our pop-ups. And so, and then we just gave them some fun names, you know.
Thus, the Macho Man burrito, which I've really enjoyed.
Yep. I was sitting at the table and was writing out the ingredients and stuff. And I was like, I need to get a permanent name for this. And then when I was done doing it, I was thinking of, you know, male perspective of like, they're the heartier eaters. And that's who I wanted to track with this burrito. And at the end of it, I just sat there and I said, oh, yeah. And right away, because the way I said it, I was like, the Macho Man, you know, from wrestling. I grew up watching wrestling, so.
He always dropped the elbow off the top rope.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, which menu items are your favorite to make for customers?
Chilaquitas. I think that is a wonderful dish. It's a kind of like an unknown in some ways. You know, we make our enchilada sauce from scratch. And just the whole concept of it, people are kind of wowed by it. And so I love introducing something new to somebody that they've never had and then wow them with the flavors that they get addicted to it.
And chilaquiles are fried tortilla chips with some cheese and sauce
and a couple fried eggs on top. And that can be in many different versions, but that's the one I chose to do for the menu.
Well, that's something to try. I also need to try a torta sandwich for lunch.
That's my other favorite, because that's my actual favorite sandwich. It's a family favorite, but we love making tortas. They're so delicious.
And what are the ingredients on your torta sandwich?
So it's a bolillo bread where it has like a crusty outside and a soft inside. We toast it with mayo and Monterey Jack cheese. And then it's your choice of meat. My favorite is carnitas with it. And it comes with lettuce, sliced tomatoes, avocado, and pickled jalapenos.
Well, and street tacos are really popular these days. I think you have three or four varieties.
Well, right now we have three main staple ones, our carne asada, our carnitas, and our pollo mexicana. But because I don't like to stick to just one pattern and there's so many flavors out there to introduce all the time, I run different specials and swap out the beef to whichever one, or chicken. And, you know, like this last one we just did was al pastor, traditionally made with pork, but I like to do chicken. And that's what we ran this week. And then we've done babacora, we've done birria. There's options.
Yeah, birria and al pastor are two of my favorites. Well, they're all my favorites, but they're all very tasty. And you've been doing some dinner service once in a while?
Yep, so now we just added on Saturday evenings. That'll happen from now on. We run 5 to 9 p.m.
But the usual hours are 8 a.m. to 2 p.m.
Yes.
Will you still be doing the mobile food trailer, or are you – the capacity is always a challenge when you have a brick and mortar?
It can be, but the idea is to still be able to do it. But we might be taking a step back for the first year, only because there's certain upgrades in the health code that they're requiring. And right now, all of our investment's in the restaurant financially, and that's where I want it to grow first. And so there are a couple that I've already booked. So we're just going to have to go back to old school ways and go under a tent again and be able to accommodate it that way. But we're probably going to take a step back. We won't be as busy out there as much.
And you still do some catering.
Yep. We cater birthday parties, office parties, weddings. We go as small as 10 people all the way up to 200 people.
Well, Maria, we're running out of time, but we could probably talk all day about Mexican food because I love your fresh flavors. Maria Ostos, thanks for being on Prairie Plates this week.
Thank you for having us.
And that's the latest edition on Prairie Plates. We'll talk to you next week.
Dakota Medical Foundation reminds listeners of Giving Hearts Day, February 12th, a 24-hour event supporting charities in North Dakota and Northwest Minnesota. Since 2008, donors have helped raise more than $226 million. Details at givingheartsday.org.
This is Main Street, continuing on this Wednesday on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and the eyes of the world are on Minneapolis. But many North Dakotans have always looked to the Twin Cities to experience a vibrant, cosmopolitan, and diverse metro area. For this week's Prairie Beat, we hear from a North Dakotan in the epicenter of the battle over immigration.
Hey, I'm Eric Dethridge.
And I'm Danielle Webster. Thank you for joining us again for another episode of Prairie Beat.
So this week on the show, we wanted to break format a bit.
Yes, so obviously immigration enforcement has been at the top of the news cycle for a few weeks now. And today we are actually going to hear from a Minneapolis resident about what they're seeing on the ground there. I was able to catch up with Jace Riggin this morning. We actually grew up in the same town, so we know a lot of the same people. And he provided us with this firsthand account.
We both grew up in the Devil's Lake area, and I think all North Dakotans are really proud of our community and how we take care of our neighbors. And when I was looking for college, I moved away to go to a small ELCA, Lutheran-affiliated college in southern Minnesota to earn my bachelor's degree. And when I started working afterward, I found a lot of opportunity and, you know, good-paying jobs in Minnesota and ended up staying. What has kept me there is I've also found a very similar close-knit community of caring neighbors and people who deeply want to take care of one another. Over the past almost 15 years now, I've been putting down roots and recently bought a home in North Minneapolis with my partner. My neighborhood is comprised of a mix of single-family homes like I live in, as well as duplex and then some rental properties. It's a diverse socioeconomic community comprised of Somali, Hmong, Latin American immigrants, as well as college-educated folks like myself, and then people who have lived there for generations. We were welcomed by our neighbors very warmly. These are people who we have dinner with, wave to in the morning across the street, or say hello, how you doing, from across the alley. Similar idea of you shovel the sidewalk when you know there's a new baby, or when somebody's having a health issue. We know each other, and we deeply care for one another.
I want to talk about Operation Metro Surge, obviously. You know, it's been going on for about a month now in Minnesota. Have you had any encounters with ICE or Border Patrol?
I was quickly, found a need from my values growing up as a Lutheran, care for your neighbor. Seeing that people who were, in fact, legal immigrants, had legal status, were being targeted, and decided to become a constitutional observer. And I want to be clear what this is. This is standing in a public space, attempting to record law enforcement in order to ensure that due process and laws are being followed when someone is in fact being detained. This is not civil disobedience. That is a different classification of action and behavior. And this is not active protest. That is also a different classification. On the morning of January 11th, it was a Sunday, I and my partner received a text that let us know that ICE agents were actively staging, which that means is they're parking, getting out of their vehicles, and walking around about 8 blocks from our home, just north of our home. This notification comes from grandmas, our neighbors we trust, people we know, pastors, watching out their windows, being on lookout for their neighbor. These are not radical protesters. These are not violent rioters. These are your everyday Minnesotans just simply watching their neighborhood and caring for their neighbors. And so we decided it was proper in our neighborhood to go care for our neighbors and legally observe the law enforcement activity, which in this case was ICE. What I saw that day was a no judicial warrant entry into Garrison Gibson's home. This happened over the course of about 2 hours. Multiple agents arrived, ranging from about 15 to 20 at any given moment. There was about an hour of just observing agents where people were making noises, blowing their whistles, attempting to alert the community to their presence. And then it became apparent that things were escalating. Multiple people were sprayed directly in the face, some engaging in protest behavior, not touching or obstructing the pathway of officers, but simply yelling or trying to gauge in conversation, asking why they were doing what they were doing or attempting to plead with them. Two individuals were sprayed directly in the face while not making contact with a vehicle and without giving adequate ability to disperse. I had to render aid to help, and one of the individuals I became concerned about due to their inability to catch their breath, and we did need to call for EMS attention. At this point in time, agents began to use a battering ram to try to enter into the home. They had large weapons drawn, as well as pepper ball. They look like paintball guns. They shoot pepper balls at the ground. So they're both less lethal and lethal weapons available. In order to ensure that EMS had a safe scene, we did need to move the people who had been impacted by both tear gas and pepper spray about a block north. Other individuals began engaging in civil disobedience, and this is where you have decided to obstruct or break a law in order to prevent something you view as morally reprehensible. And this involves maybe putting your body in front of an officer or in front of a car. This is not violence. This is not rioting. This is a deep tradition in America, and it is a moral tradition for individuals who may object. Again, it is peaceful. It is not violent. This is different than a protester who might be not engaging in obstruction or stopping of an officer, who is simply voicing their displeasure. Maybe they are saying shame. Maybe they are pleading for them to stop. Maybe they are chanting. And so there were three actions I was witnessing happening. Four, you know, active community aid, legal observing, protesting, and then civil disobedience. What I did later see was the removal of Garrison Gibson from his home. Multiple other individuals attempting to engage in civil disobedience to stop that removal from him in the home. They were sprayed with chemical agents, the chemical irritants as well, and then aid was needing to be rendered by multiple people there. Garrison Gibson was taken away, and individuals did follow the ICE vehicles while still engaging in protest and legal observation. This was not violent. This was strategic, calm neighbors engaging in an act of love and concern for a neighbor, which in the end, it did turn out to be a illegal entry and detainment of an individual who is here on lawful status without a judicial signed warrant. These are the constitutional violations that are playing out. They are First Amendment, they are Second Amendment, they are Fourth Amendment violations. Due process is not being followed for both U.S. citizens as well as legal residents and those who are here possibly without legal status. And that is what is at issue for many Minnesotans, is the lack of due process. And so scenes like this that I have witnessed are what are playing out across the metro, where caring neighbors are simply engaging in a variety of behaviors to aid their neighbors through food, shelter, other forms of maybe it is rent assistance. If they are sheltering in place, they are attempting to legally observe, which is a constitutionally protected behavior. Even if people don't like it, it is constitutionally protected.
What is the current status of your neighbor, Mr. Garrison?
He was detained after being initially released on a judge's order and then released again.
Now, here in North Dakota, you know, a lot of folks are watching social media, maybe whatever news media, to form their opinions on what's been going on in Minnesota. But, you know, as we've been discussing, you are living this. It's your reality daily. What would you like your friends and neighbors from back home to know about what your community, what your state is experiencing right now?
I think I want you to talk with Native elders in North Dakota, because the violation of constitutional rights that we're seeing in Minnesota are not new. Indigenous people have been suffering at the hands and being resilient and surviving at the hands of the federal government violating due process rights for a very long time. And so I want that to be a starting and grounding place, that what's happening in Minneapolis by immigration enforcement and CBP isn't new. It is just a new expression.
What are your hopes for the future for your community and your state? You take the sky away.
Minnesota is incredibly resilient. We are a strong state. There is a rich tradition of civic participation, art, public funding of community needs and neighborly support. There's also multiple religious traditions at work across the Twin Cities and secular communities that do this work and amplify it. So we're good. We got this. What will be the end of the federal occupation? Because I feel the tide is turning, but I think that we need allies, and we need people who might have agreed with this, who now disagree, to understand that you can say no, and you can be part of stopping what is happening and the violations that are happening by Immigration and Customs and CBP right now in our country.
Thank you so much for your time today, Jace. I really appreciate you joining us.
You're so welcome. Thank you.
Well, a riveting account there, Danielle. It's nice to have somebody bear witness from our home state. Thank you for bringing this story to light today.
Absolutely. And, you know, we're keeping our eyes on this story and all the other stories making news from our region as well. So tune into Prairie Public for more of those stories or check us out online at news.prairiepublic.org.
All right. So that's it for this week on Prairie Beat. I'm Eric Etheridge.
And I'm Danielle Webster. We'll see you on the beat next week.
You can subscribe to our weekly news podcast, Prairie Beat, wherever you get your favorites. I'm the next to survive this MN flow.
No, I'm one of the nicest. Took a bite out the game thing bigger than when West. The Cinema 100 Winter Film Series continues on Thursday, January 15th with 9 more films, including Sentimental Value, the Iranian film It Was Just an Accident, If I Had Legs, I'd Kick You, and the American 1970s classic Chinatown. Each film is shown twice on Thursdays at 3 and 6 p.m. at the Grand 22 Theater in Bismarck. More information on the entire series is available at the Cinema 100 Facebook page.
If you're listening to the 3 p.m. broadcast of Main Street, catch up on the news and stories from around the world, the nation, and here at home on All Things Considered. That's up next on Prairie Public. And if you're listening to us during the evening broadcast, keep it here for Travel with Rick Steves. That follows Main Street on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for January 28th. Prior to the 19th century, time was a local matter. Each town set a public clock to noon when the sun was at its highest point. Towns close together could be on different times. This system worked well enough until the railroads arrived. Travelers found schedules confusing since each stop followed a different local time. It was often hard to know exactly when a train would arrive or depart. The problem was solved in 1883 when the United States adopted the 4 time zones we know today. Railroads emphasized the importance of staying on time. Travelers wanted to reach their destinations on time. Businesses depended on railroads to deliver goods on time. The post office expected mail to arrive on time. Railroads took pride in their ability to keep schedules. But the push to stay on time sometimes had dire consequences. In late January of 1910, a terrible accident occurred near Mandan. The train had been delayed, and the engineer was desperately trying to make up lost time. Known as a doubleheader, a second engine had been added for extra power. The train was running at top speed when it hit a broken rail. The two engines and the mail car left the tracks, but remained upright. The remaining cars rolled onto their sides and came to a rest in the snow. The train was full of passengers. 65 people were injured, and it was considered miraculously that no one was killed. On this date in 1910, newspapers also reported another costly accident on the Northern Pacific. As a wheat train approached the depot at Mackenzie, one car dropped to the track and spread the rails. That car derailed, followed by all the cars behind it. Wheat spilled across the prairie. The track in front of the depot was torn out, and the platform was wrecked. In addition to the lost cargo, 2 rail crews needed 72 hours to repair the damage and get the trains moving again. Sometimes, the effort to stay on time led to long delays. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Dr. Carol Butcher. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Dr. Julie Peterman Bryant of the Bryant Clinic of Chiropractic and Acupuncture in Bismarck. Naturally working with people to feel better, be healthy, and live well at all ages.
And that wraps up this Wednesday's edition of Main Street. We are deeply grateful that you spent time with us. Tomorrow on the show, a closer look with the Monitor. It's a lawsuit that accuses North Dakota lawmakers of violating the Constitution with a term limits ballot measure. Plus, we'll introduce a new segment, Tech with Peck. My longtime friend George Peck will join us to learn more about consumers and the technology we all use. That's all ahead tomorrow on Main Street. and we look forward to your joining us again.